This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
And I want to look at a couple of passages that will sort of lead the way for us. So let's have a look now at Job chapter 12. How long has it been since you went into Job? It's big, big book. You just got a few verses from it. And so look at what it says here in the middle of a thought here. It says, "But ask the beasts, and they will teach you. The birds of the heavens, and they will tell you. Or speak to the earth, and it will teach you. And the fish of the sea will declare to you. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In his hand is the life of every living thing, and the breath of all mankind." And then from Job to Jesus. Okay, so in the sermon he gave, the famous one. Here's what he said, just a couple of lines from it. When he's talking to the crowd and he says, "Consider the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these." Two places, disparate places, different, you know, places in the scripture. And we could choose a whole lot more, especially if we went, for example, to the Psalms, like we did last week. And what we saw last week from the Psalms and from readings in the prophets is that what the writers do often is they glorify God by enumerating all the things around in the world. They sort of classify them. They look at them. They don't just generically say, with a sort of in one umbrella statement, "Wow, creation is really cool. Thank the Lord for the great creation." They get specific. The psalmist, remember, goes through sort of a taxonomy of it, sort of specifies it. You know, he goes through and lists, he itemizes things. Look at this and look at that. And have you noticed this? And check out that. And it's all just so amazing. And the implication, and it's really more than an implication, is that God is glorified in even the minute details of his work. And really we see more of this every day. We see more of this as time goes on. Because as time goes on, we see more things. I say we, I just mean sort of like humanity. Because there are people who work hard in all the different sciences to discover more things. And they discover a lot of pretty cool things. And the way this works, of course, is that people take lifetimes. And so numerous lifetimes have happened where people start to see and unlock some things and see things more closely, even way back. You've got to get back to before telescopes could see so far and microscopes could see down so deep. And then people start to discover things. But the thing is, you only have one lifetime to do it. And so people started to pass on what they did. So one person will spend a lifetime and discover a lot of things and sort of make some headway to sort of figuring it out. And then they pass it on like a baton to the next guy in the relay. And the next person already has a leg up because of all the work previously done. This is how science moves along. Because it's just sort of like if you were the last guy in the relay and you won the race, you wouldn't take all the credit as if you ran all those previous legs. In fact, what if the only reason you won, what if the other people in the last leg were faster than you, but the previous runners on your team were just faster, and so you got the baton a full minute before the other ones? So we sit here no smarter than anyone who went before us, but coming later in the race after all their work was done, and so now we see more than they saw. As Newton said, "You know, I'm sitting, I'm standing on the shoulders of the giants, and that's how I see further than they saw, because I'm standing up higher. They allowed me to do that." The result of all of this work over these generations has been increasing amazement, genuinely, increasing amazement, the more that has been learned. And this doesn't surprise us. Should this surprise us that the closer we look and the further we look and the deeper it goes, that we would be more amazed? This is what we should have believed anyway. And the best of us, the best Christian thinkers and theologians always knew that would probably be the case. Martin Luther said once, if you could understand a single grain of wheat, you would probably die of wonder. So it's sort of known and should be known that this ought to happen. And it's happened in such a way that even some people who had long-time views that were not predisposed to the Creator start to wonder if maybe they got it wrong. So you remember the man I told you about last week, Anthony Flew, who I read in seminary as the token philosophical atheist from his decades at Oxford teaching as an atheist. And how I was shocked to discover a book years after I graduated written by that same guy. And in this book he was saying, I think I had got it wrong. And now I think there must really be a creator. And what had persuaded him were advances. You see, this goes against the standard view in a lot of minds, the secular type of view, which really imagines that the more we learn, why, the less inclined we'll be to think of a creator. Because after all, with the increase of our knowledge goes the decrease of our sense of wonder, of our appreciation for the idea that God would have made things, that would drop off. Because after all, we learn more about it. So now we sort of get it. All that mystical, magical stuff, we don't need that anymore. Now we understand it. But in fact, it's just been the opposite. It's been the opposite. And so, as we read, as we see the Psalm saying, look at this and look at that, as you see in Job, and as you hear in the words of Jesus saying, consider the birds, consider the lilies, I want to say to you this morning, consider a couple of more things. Consider a few more things that nowadays we have a look at, that they're privy to, that they weren't in prior times. And I want to say, consider these and consider what they mean. Consider what they point to. So I mentioned three of them. One of them is the fine tuning of creation. One of them is the most basic thing, all living things, the little tiny cell, the humblest thing, right? The cell. And then, of course, the complicated book that makes you, the instructions, your DNA. We know about these things now. We know much more about them. But what does it mean that we know more? What does it mean for our core belief that we believe in the maker of heaven and earth? What do these findings have to do with that belief? And so I say, consider these things, and I'll say a few things about them. Probably more about the first one because I just ran out of time. Now, I put fine-tuning in quotes because it's not my term. It's not my term. It's a common term that they use. The people who study this, use this term themselves. So I'm borrowing it. I didn't invent the term. What does it refer to? Well, the more that physicists have studied all the details of the way the universe is, the more they come to this principle, and they call it the anthropic principle. That's a Greek word for humanity that's used in the Bible over and over. Anthropos, man, human beings. They call it that because the principle is that there are a thousand different variables that are just the way they have to be in order for you and in order for me to be in this room right now. We couldn't be here without them being dialed up just right. So this principle, they say, points to the numerous constants in the universe that must be exactly as they are, or there's just no way that we would be here. It's a sort of a very delicate, careful balance. Now you think, well, what are some of the examples of those things? And with this, I will list for you some of the things they talk about with a full knowledge that it's very likely that few of us, if any, really understand in any deep way what these things are talking about. But we can at least appreciate them as far as those who know about it study it. But I'll list them for you because you can Google this. Plenty of written on this about these variables and these constants in the physical universe. And so, for example, they will point to things like the electromagnetic equations in the universe that reflect the physics of the universe, the conditions that have to be present for nuclei to form. The ratios of electromagnetic force to gravity, they got to be just the way it has to be, just like it is. Or the electron to proton mass, that ratio couldn't be off by a hair. Or the entropy level, or the velocity of light, it's got to be just what it is, they say. Or the positioning of the Earth on its axis, tilted just like it is. And the exact distance from our sun being exactly the size it needs to be. And our moon plays an important role. And all of these very sensitive atmospheric elements, they've all got to be just the way they are. If you want more details, I invite you to just go hog wild on the internet and look this idea up about fine-tuning. And it'll overwhelm you. If you're scientifically minded, you could spend all day on this. But it's almost as though you can picture a panel of 100 dials. You know, like, have you ever looked in the cockpit of an airplane? You know, you see a thousand instrumental dials, and you think, I wouldn't know what to do with all those. What if all of them go from 0 to 100, and each one of them has to be set on its exact number? This one has to be on 28, this one has to be on 35, this one has to be on 77. And all 100 of those dials have to be set just like they need to be, or it's no go. And what are the odds that blind forces would happen to set them just right? That's the idea. And so, some scientists have been pointing this out for some years now. So, for example, the Princeton physicist Freeman Dyson said, "As we look out into the universe and identify the many accidents of physics and astronomy that have worked together to our benefit, it seems almost as if the universe must, in some sense, have known we were coming." Or the Cambridge astronomer Fred Hoyle. He said, "A common sense interpretation of these facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics, as well as with chemistry and biology. The numbers that one calculates from these facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question." Hoyle, of course, is the same guy who used the analogy of a tornado that blows through a junkyard and through the forces of its winds happens to assemble from the junk parts a functional Boeing 747. His analogy. Then there's Paul Davies, who's an astrophysicist. And here's a quote from him, I'll show you, where he says, "The cliche that life is balanced on a knife edge is a staggering understatement in this case. No knife in the universe could have an edge that fine." Davies also said, "Scientists are slowly waking up to this truth that the universe looks suspiciously like a fix." He says, "For 40-some years, physicists and cosmologists have quietly been collecting examples of all-too-convenient coincidences and special features in the underlying laws of the universe that seem to be necessary in order for life and conscious beings to exist. You change any one of them, even a little bit, the consequences would be lethal." And so, this is probably beyond our ken, as they say. It's above our scholastic pay grade. We didn't study these things. We don't know a lot about these things, unless you're into it. But it should have our attention. Because the psalmist says, look at this, and how about that? And isn't that amazing? And doesn't that blow your mind over there? And we say, how primitive. Why, he didn't even know what it was all about. He's living back in the ancient times. And here we sit, and we hear the modern-day astrophysicists say, wow, look at those equations. Look at the numbers. Look at the odds. Why, it's like 1 in 10 to the 165th power that variable would be like that by chance, and that's just one of many variables. Isn't that amazing? Just like the psalmist said, isn't that amazing? Oh, it's amazing, all right. And so you see, closer we look and the more we discover about it. And by the way, that doesn't mean that everyone who recognizes this is a church-going, hallelujah-singing Christian. People like Stephen Hawking recognized it. They weren't sure what to do with it. They came up with all kinds of ideas how maybe it could have happened by chance. Maybe, there's some... I mean, the theories, they had to get creative. But there are quotes even from Hawking himself basically saying, yeah, this really looks remarkably peculiar. I mean, it really looks intricately designed. Sometimes people's worldview won't let them go all the way with it. But they just don't know what else to do with it. And so the universe, finely tuned, very finely tuned. I hope our instruments were finely tuned this morning. But if they were, that's nothing compared to just how much tuning is involved in all of these things to be just like they are. Well, I'll also commend to you and say, consider the cell. Consider the cell. You learned about it in school when you were a kid, didn't you? And then you diagrammed it, you saw a little bit. Well, they've done a lot of work since then on the cell, on everything that's happening inside the cell. And this connects to the idea of your DNA, but just the cell by itself, just the simple, humble little thing, the cell. They look down, they call it nanotechnology, It's a micro level like never before. They can now look real close. And the closer they keep looking, the more they find things. Right? And so here's the late Cambridge scientist. Thorpe, he says, the most elementary type of cell constitutes a mechanism unimaginably more complex than any machine yet thought up, let alone constructed by man. And a recent scientist and scientific writer wrote this book, The Signature in the Cell. And so as another scientist explained, he says the complex structure of the living cell was unknown in Darwin's day. Darwin imagined the cell like a blob. It could have been just a simple blob. And he says, but now the technology of the 20th century has delved into the tiniest particles of life and has revealed that the cell is the most complex system mankind has ever confronted. Today we know that the cell contains power stations producing the energy to be used by the cell, factories that are manufacturing the enzymes and hormones essential for life, a data bank where all the necessary information about all products to be produced is recorded, complex transportation systems and pipelines for carrying raw materials and products from one place to another, advanced laboratories and refineries for breaking down external raw materials into their usable parts, and specialized cell membrane proteins to control the incoming and outgoing materials. And these constitute only a small part of this incredibly complex system. Is that not something? The simple cell. Not nearly as simple as we thought. And when you think about that, you think, whoa. And all of these parts have to work together. And this has led some people to talk about what they call irreducible complexity. In other words, a thing, as small as it is, can be so complex that you cannot reduce it any further. In other words, you cannot now imagine any of its parts without the rest. It is irreducibly complex. And how does such a thing, so complex, simply come to exist? By blind forces, without a plan. You see, you get the idea. And it's amazing now that some of the simple things, like one writer I saw uses the idea of the bacterial flagellum, the little whip that kind of helps propel the tiny bacteria. He says now when you look in some of the literature about these things, they'll diagram something like the bacterial flagellum and they'll use mechanical language. They'll say, yeah, this is an O-ring and this is a bushing. They're borrowing the language of mechanics to talk about those things. But all of that seems to beg us to ask, really? Because stuff like that stuff with O-rings and bushings gets built by people. We don't just find it lying in a forest because of the forces of wind and erosion. Well, so how about DNA? Another thing I said, let's consider DNA. We're complex beings. Back in the 90s, I think it was, our government commissioned and funded a project that they called the Human Genome Project to try to get to the bottom of this, you know, this thing that's in us, the old double helix, and how's all that work, and how do we map that out, and can we sort of see, could we sort of unlock this code and understand it better? And they spent money and time with a team of scientists to do this. The man who headed up that project is Francis Collins, who, after it was over, wrote a book on it. And here's his book. And he called it The Language of God. And so what he said was, in one quote, "The God of the Bible," Collins said, "is also the God of the genome. He can be worshipped in the cathedral or in the laboratory. His creation is majestic, awesome, intricate, and beautiful." That's not a preacher talking. That's a scientist. So, DNA, wildly complex, the instructions for our every living thing, reams of information, specially coded, like an incredibly complicated code book. And the information theorists will tell you that it's real hard to imagine how any natural forces could create information. Information is the stuff of minds or computers that minds made. Information theory. Even the co-discoverer of DNA, Francis Crick, said that, quote, "An honest man," Crick said, "an honest man, armed with all the knowledge now available to us, could only say that in some sense or another, the origin of life appears almost to be a miracle. So many are the conditions that are required that have to be satisfied just to get it going." You hear this time and again. Consider it, brothers, consider it. Consider the lilies. Consider the birds. Consider your own DNA. Consider each one of the however many billion cells in maybe just you. Consider the fact that there's you know, all these hundreds of equations that reflect the way that the physical world is and the universe. And here we sit. Here we sit, you look up at the stars, you've got this vantage point, you've got this moon, gives some reflects the sun, light off of it, gives you a little bit of moonlight, and just so happens that whenever they align the shadow of the earth, you get that really cool eclipse, and it's so another one of those cool little features that they happen to line up like two quarters stacked. You know, it's one of those things when you watch the nature shows, and you think, how about that? And what we really ought to think is, we ought to go back each time to the words of Job. And we should say, "Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this?"